right.
Well, welcome to the new Contrivia podcast. We've been away for a little while, and we've been, you know, let's be honest, pretty inactive on the site in general lately, you know, for the past 3 weeks or so. We had a good, strong three-week opener.
Yeah.
Where we, you know, had some, some regular content there, and you know, I guess we got pretty bored pretty quickly there with it. Or, what's your excuse?
I hate the sound of my own voice.
Okay, what about the sound? What about the sound of your writing voice? Because we haven't been writing either.
That I hate. Also.
Okay. Well, I've been getting over a pretty nasty sinus infection and ear infection that lasted about 3 weeks, and my brother's been in town, and his friends, so, you know, and other such lame excuses. I did have a dream last night that I had been doing a lot of writing for the site.
Yeah?
Yeah, my output was fantastic.
Wow, great.
Yeah, I was proud of myself. So my subconscious is getting awesome. A lot of work done.
Yeah. A lot of good progress on the dream front.
Right. Well, but we do have a treat for everyone this time around.
Indeed.
I bagged a pretty big fish.
Yeah.
For years, I have been corresponding with Noam Chomsky, and I finally was able to get an interview with him that took place a couple of weeks ago. And so, you know,
outstanding.
Yes, I'm pretty proud of myself for this one. So, without further ado, why don't we go ahead and get to that?
Yes,
here is the premiere of the Contrivia exclusive interview with Professor Noam Chomsky.
Okay.
So pretty riveting stuff there.
Hard-hitting, two-fisted journalism.
Yeah. So I shit the bed on that one.
Yeah. What happened?
Well, I read the email wrong. It said May 21st, and I thought it said March 21st.
Okay.
And so the interview will happen, just not as soon as I had wanted. So, but do stay tuned. There, we will eventually be premiering an interview with Noam Chomsky later on.
And what you can do is subscribe to Paul's Subconscious podcast, which has been talking to Chomsky for the last 3 weeks.
Absolutely,
in his
yeah.
series about the build-up to the war.
Shit, last many years, you know, I've been subconsciously talking to Chomsky. Okay, well, let's get to what we're going to talk about. We're going to do two reviews in this podcast. We're going to review the premiere of Game of Thrones. And then we're going to talk about a documentary, the new documentary that hit theaters recently called Room 237 that's about the theories on The Shining. But let's start with Game of Thrones.
Okay.
It's back in all its glory. Mm-hmm. I did a quick binge refresher the week before it came back on and rewatched seasons 1 and 2, so I was super psyched and ready for it. I guess we should probably both say that we both have not read the books.
Right.
We only know the series from the HBO show. But what'd you think? What'd you think of the premiere?
I actually did not get to do a refresher. So I probably should have done it, but I just did not have the means to sit down and, you know, collect every episode from the prior seasons and go over them again. So I came into it kind of fuzzy.
Yeah.
The first half hour, I was sort of lost, you know, and it focused mostly on the characters that I don't care as much about, to be honest with you. Jon Snow, that stuff is pretty cool, but I just, you know, that stuff didn't stick with me. It doesn't resonate with me for whatever reason as much as, you know, the Tyrion stuff, the Sansa stuff,
right.
You know, so I still enjoyed it for the most part, but I was still like, okay, where's Khaleesi? Where's, you know? And when it finally did get to that stuff, I was like, you know, totally, you know, riveted. It's still just as good as ever. The dialogue is superb. The character interactions and everything. Tyrion getting chewed out by his father.
How tough was that scene?
That was, I think, my favorite moment.
Wow. I think that was hands down the best moment in the show.
Yeah.
Sunday night. Man, I mean, like, you know, Charles Dance that plays Tywin Lannister, he's such a fantastic actor, that guy, you know, and he throughout the series has been able to, since, you know, he's kind of an evil bastard, he's still been able to elicit empathy, you know, like, especially his interactions with Arya, you know, when he didn't know that she was Arya, like, all that stuff, like, you kind of like him at times, you know, even though, like, he's like one of those kind of bad guys that's interesting in a way. But man, you just hated him in that scene, man.
Yeah.
They just, like, the claws came out of, like, the real Tywin. And but what a great setup though for what Tyrion the imp is going to have to be dealing with this season, you know, the balance of power should be very interesting. But holy shit, man. Like, to tell him, you know, like, you have my name by the laws of this land, but if, you know, it's only because I can't prove that you're not mine.
The whole thing about him waddling around wearing that lie, and that was my father's sigil and his father's before his, and and you know, as the series goes on, Tyrion becomes, like, you know, your favorite character, if not, you know, one of your favorites.
I mean, I think he's hands down the most interesting, fun character.
Yeah, and then for him to, you know, you finally come around to liking him, and then is you have that awkward moment where his dad kind of, you know, shits on him and everything. And
yeah. I love that, though. I love that, because, you know, I mean, he did, you know, save King's Landing. I mean, like, you know, if, I mean, granted, you know, Tywin came in and mopped up what he had done, but, I mean, the Battle of Blackwater Bay, I mean, if Tyrion had not, you know, handled it the way he did, you know, I mean, the King's Landing would have been sacked by Stannis. So it's, you know, I think he does deserve gratitude, you know, and I think it's great that they knocked him down into such a weak position after being so high, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's riveting television and puts you, you know, on the edge for, okay, well, what's going to happen to him now, you know? Let's call him out on something, though, because even though, like, you know, I believe he either won a Golden Globe or an Emmy or both for his performance in this show. And he is fantastic, Peter Dinklage, in the show. But let's give him some shit that he does not have a great British accent.
He doesn't.
You know?
I've kind of, you know, been iffy about that from the get-go. I've kind of always, you know, I've picked up on it and been like, ooh, is he, you know, I don't know, I think that's a little shaky. I'm not British myself. I've never spent any time over there. But I, you know, so I'm no authority on the matter, and I'm not, like, a dialogue coach or anything.
Right.
But I do kind of, like, you know, the spots come up where it's like, oh, wow, like, because
it's
the fact he's acting with so many other, like, British actors have to talk.
Well, there's only two Americans on the show.
Yeah.
And the other one's gone. The guy that played Khal Drogo or whatever was American.
Right.
But the rest is all British European cast, you know. So yeah, I mean, like, but I just, you know, everyone just calls out how good he is, and he is fantastic, don't get me wrong. Like, you don't care, really, that he's, you know, that the accent's bad, but nobody gives him shit about that, and I think he deserves a little bit of shit. It's not a very good British accent.
You know? No, it's sort of, to be honest, it's always sort of, you know, like, as much as every time he comes on the screen, I get excited, because it's like, oh, there's my guy.
Yeah.
But when he talks, it's like, oof, you know, it does kind of, it's not, I don't know, it is a bit jarring.
Yeah.
You know, it does sort of pull you out, you know, and I hate saying that.
Because a tiny bit.
He's the reason I go to the show, you know what I mean? Like, he's like my main draw, and at the same time, he's also kind of like the, you know, a source of a you know, certain flaw that within the show that sort of sometimes, you know, shakes me out of that.
Well, let's talk about who we didn't get in this episode. We didn't get any Arya. We don't know what's going on with
her. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I missed that? Did something happen? Where the hell was she?
She just wasn't in it. So.
She's one of my favorites.
Yeah, she's great. She's great. Yeah.
Where the hell was she?
Yeah. So
I would have traded the guy with the, you know, the the dude that got picked up by the boat, I would have traded him for the...
Oh, yeah, I like that guy, though. But yeah, yeah, I can't remember his name. Yeah, the Stannis' guy that gets thrown in jail. Yeah, yeah, but I would have rather... but, you know, I guess they're saving it for episode two, some of that stuff. We didn't get any Theon Greyjoy.
Right.
You know, last we saw him, he got, you know, knocked out in Winterfell. We don't know what's going on in Winterfell. It was smoldering, you know, when they left it last. Obviously, Theon is alive, you know, and is somewhere. But I'm curious to see what's going on there. I was glad to see Bronn again, because you didn't get him in the last episode of season two. And you know, he's not head of the Night's Watch anymore, but, you know, he's a knight and seemed to be enjoying himself. He's a great character. He's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
No Jaime Lannister.
No.
And what's her name? Who's escorting him, I guess, back to King's Landing, I guess, is where they're going, you know. So it was a good setup, you know, for about half the characters. Right. And then you really didn't get half, you know. So we've got kind of like the arcs of what's going to start with half of them, and then we still have yet to see, you know, what's going on with the rest. You know, so, I mean, you can maybe say that was part of a problem with the episode, but I was totally satisfied with the episode. I give it solid B+, A-.
Sure. You know, you know. I mean, yeah, I, you know, there were, you know, for the first half hour, like I said, was sort of like, oh, yeah, okay, all right, these guys. You know, I was waiting to get to the Khaleesi and, you know, all my favorites and everything, but it was still, like, it wasn't the worst thing in the world to have to, you know, watch that.
Yeah,
you know, those scenes. It's still like a really tight show. It's got an amazing cast.
Right,
the performances are exquisite. I just, you know, it's like I miss Arya. And, you know, I was excited for, you know, what's Khaleesi doing right now? What's Khaleesi doing right now?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
By the time it got to her, like, that was some badass stuff. Like
that stuff was awesome.
If you know the dialogue between Tyrion and his father was great, but the action, that all the stuff that went down when she was trying to buy those soldiers, and like the whole backstory of the soldiers, and like just the guys like sneering,
cutting
like, you
off
know,
the nipple,
calling her a whore, you know,
that little interplay of like, you know, between the translator was great,
just really well written, and then the stuff with what is it, the warlocks or whatever, at the
end. that was
cool,
badass.
So.
Very exciting. You know, season two, even though there were people who complained about the whole, her whole kind of subplot in Quarth, or whatever the name of that city was, where she, some people found that stuff boring. I mean, I thought it was okay, you know, like, I wasn't totally bored by it, but I definitely liked the warlock stuff that was going on in that city, and I'm glad to see, you know, see, like, I'm ready to, like, because Game of Thrones has always been just teeming under the surface with its hard fantasy elements, you know? And you know it's getting there eventually. Mm-hmm. Eventually we're going to have White Walker battles, big-ass dragons.
Giants.
You know, we got a giant this time around, which, man, they handle the special effects so well on that show. You know, those dragons could look so stupid, and they look fantastic.
Definitely.
And, but yeah, so I'm excited. Another thing I will say about Game of Thrones is that I will often be annoyed with, like, you know, network dramas when everyone is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it starts to feel very TV, very hackneyed when everyone is just strikingly beautiful.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones pulls it off,
right?
You know, and I don't know if it's because they're all primarily, you know, British and European actors, why they're so good, but, you know, half the cast are just drop dead gorgeous, the men and the women.
Right.
And I never once feel like, oh, that cast, they were just cast because they're beautiful. You know, like you do sometimes on. You know, shows on the main networks.
Yeah.
So I
think some of it is because they're, you know, for the most part, they're all really solid actors.
Yeah.
The other thing is that even though they're all, like, almost across the board, you know, pretty remarkably beautiful, they're all actually, like, they look like normal people. Like, they don't look like the kind of person you'd see on a, you know, magazine cover, a bus stop ad or something like that. They look like, you know, a very, very beautiful person that you'd meet if you, like, were, you know, walking down the street or something like that. It wouldn't be like...
I guess, man. I don't know. I could totally see Emilia Clarke as a, you know, as a model for something, you know. I mean, but I see what you're saying. They do have kind of a distinct...
They look like normal people,
you know? Yeah.
In addition to being beautiful. They don't look like you know, robots or whatever.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right, yeah. I think...
Cookie cutter, supermodel.
No, totally. I think more than anything, it really just is performances. But also, maybe there's something to say about they are like playing nobles, and you know, they just
that's true too.
You know, it's so well cast, though. Yeah. You know, the only guy that I'm a little iffy on his performance is what's his name, Carsetti from The Wire. You know, who plays Littlefinger. Adrian Gillen or whatever, Baelish, you know, who plays Baelish.
Right.
I just feel like sometimes his performance is a little flat, you know. And I thought he was pretty much perfect as Carsetti in The Wire. But something about him every now, I think he looks the part enough, you know. But every now and then I feel like, you know, that line delivery was a little shaky.
Yeah.
You know?
He gives me the creeps enough to where I kind of enjoy him as a villain, though.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love the character, and his performance doesn't, you know, bother me or anything, but right. Just every now and then I feel like it's not up to par with the rest of the cast.
Right. You know? Like, I get what you're saying.
You know who I don't think gets enough praise for their performance is Lena Headey, or whatever her name is, Headey, as Cersei.
Mm.
Like, that performance is just mesmerizingly good. You know, like, the fact that she's not being nominated for Emmys and
yeah,
and
stuff, yeah.
She's just perfect, you know.
Like, there's teeming with that evil energy. Yeah,
but there's nuance to it, though, you know? I mean, like, you have empathy for her, whereas, like, for Joffrey, you really don't have too much. Like, he's the super evil one that, even though I think the performance is great, you don't have too much, you know, empathy for that character. You kind of want bad things to happen to him.
Yeah.
Whereas Cersei, you do understand a little bit where she's coming from. You don't agree with her decisions, you know, but she sells it so well, and I think that so much of that is... as he gives her a little bit of humanity, you know, in that character. You know, like, there's a scene in season 2 where, you know, she's sitting down with Tyrion, and at one point she says, you know, maybe this is, you know, we're getting answered for our sins, you know, or something like that, talking about, you know, that Joffrey was the product of incest or whatever.
Yeah,
and you see her doubt, you know, for a moment. And I think, you know, we're going to have an interesting interplay in this season with her. Because it's really hard to say where King's Landing is going, you know, the power structure. And now that, you know, Joffrey's got a new, you know, queen or whatever. And that was interesting to see her go talk to the poor, you know, and whatnot. So it's like kind of setting up, like, you know, butting heads of both with Joffrey and Cersei, the new queen, you know.
What are your thoughts towards that character? I can't remember what the character's name is.
It's Marjorie Anne Boleyn or something, or
in The Tudors.
Yeah, I never saw The Tudors. What I can't remember her name. It starts with an M, I believe. Super hot. She was, you know, Rennie Baratheon's.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Unconsummated queen. You know.
Right.
Yeah. I think she's great.
Yeah.
I think it's a great performance. It's another one of those absolutely stunningly gorgeous casting, but she pulls it off, you know. She kind of comes out of nowhere, you know, a little bit. Like, you didn't really see her, you know, being the queen, you know, like, until she just pops up at the end of season 2. But I like what they did, and I really like that scene where she goes out and, like, gives toys to the poor and, you know, you know, she's playing the game, you know?
Right.
So, there's, you know, and that's just one thing to be said about Game of Thrones, is that it reminds me of Deadwood a little bit, you know, in its sort of, like, Machiavellian interplay with the characters and the power shifting and sharing and, you know, the sort of, like, it's got a Shakespearean aspect to it, but I love the politics of it. You know, you're constantly wondering, you know, which maneuver is going to, you know, work to put the next person in power and whatever. And it's just so much fun to watch. You know, I think it's a pretty much flawless show. You know, HBO has done it again. You know, I mean, with The Wire and Deadwood and this and, you know, Sopranos. I mean, shit. They really have produced some of the absolute greatest television of all time.
See, I wish I had gone back and marathoned the first two seasons and caught up and refreshed on it and everything.
I always do that when a new show, when a new season's coming out.
Yeah, I mean, it probably would have helped a lot. I mean, and also it would have, you know, because the first time through you're watching it for story, the second time through you're catching all the nuances and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, so like I the second time through I watched it with the subtitles on.
Yeah.
Know, just to catch it even more, you know, little things that were going on. And I'm sure there's still stuff I missed.
Yeah.
Know? It probably needs to be seen three or four times, you know.
Right.
But yeah, like I just did that with Mad Men too, because it premieres next week.
And that's the other show that I didn't do that with, you know?
Like, I didn't do the whole series. I did do the whole series before. I just redid 5 again.
Yeah.
But before 5 came on, I decided to go redo the entire
series. I did do that.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty, you know, stable when it comes to that. But yeah, I 5 is still like a one-time pass for me, so I probably need to at least get the cliff notes or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, Game of Thrones, they don't even have, like, a recap at the beginning, at the top of the episode or
they
anything.
They did with this one.
They did? Okay, yeah. The one I saw didn't have.
I always skip those, though, because you can tell what's going to show up in this episode by watching those. You know, the West Wing was bad about that.
Yeah.
You know, you watch that, and you're like, oh, well, we're going to get this character in this one, we're going to get this, you know, I mean, like... So yeah, I hate it when they're like, you know, stay tuned for scenes for the next episode. No, the fuck I will not. You know? I don't want to see anything about the next episode. You know,
yeah.
Game of Thrones and HBO obviously don't really do that much, but okay. But we both loved it. We're
great psyched. Show.
Starting next week, we're gonna have Game of Thrones and Mad Men on. You know,
yeah.
So
that'll be a fun podcast because we will be recording one.
I'm sure from now on.
At least Paul subconscious has that cornered.
Yeah, definitely. Let's move on to Room 237. This was a documentary that actually premiered last year at some of the film festivals and whatnot, and it's finally gotten a like limited release. It's a documentary by Rodney Asher, who I had really never seen anything before, but this is his first feature length, so it's really his kind of first movie in a way. It's about it takes, what is it, like, I guess it's 5 different you know, people, and it who are super nutty fans of The Shining and of Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining, and basically lets them, you know, run rampant and explain their theories and of what they think The Shining is really about. And so you get everything from somebody who thinks that it's about the Holocaust, somebody who, that there's subtle, you know, symbolism for these things. Somebody says there's the Holocaust, somebody says it's about the genocide of the Native Americans, you know, someone says it's about Kubrick secretly confessing his involvement with the Apollo moon, faking the Apollo moon landing and whatnot, you know, but, and then the film itself is, you know, intercut. It never shows the interview subjects. It shows scenes from The Shining, and also, like, you know, there's some other Kubrick films in there that it intercuts from, but basically it dissects these people's theories and shows them to you. People are loving this documentary. It's right now, of the films that are currently in release, it's the one with the highest score on Metacritic. You know, critics are pretty much flipping out about this thing. What did you think?
I thought, for the most part, it really made me want to go back and watch these, you know, classic Kubrick movies again. I really want to watch The Shining again as soon as possible. I want to see 2001 again as soon as possible. The individual, you know, theories and everything regarding, you know, the actual story that's inside of The Shining, I couldn't really care less about what these people think is actually none of it is plausible. It's all just outlandish. It's crazy. I understand that that's not the point. The point is not to sell you on what these people are proposing. It's to actually, it's kind of like to study, you know, like what you were saying is like obsession, or, you know, just people that can't leave something alone, that they have to, like, they see a kernel of, you know, these people, the evidence that they have for their theories, it's all the same thing. It's that they have like a personal connection to something in their life, and so they start kind of imprinting these, you know, little facets of this connection into the movie where they wouldn't normally be, right, you know, reading a number backwards or whatever, or seeing continuity errors that must hint at what they assume it hints at, even though the next person says the same
thing. Yeah, there's conflicting things that they see,
So there's no actual evidence for anything that is, but it's not supposed to sell you on these theories as being viable theories for what The Shining is actually about, as much as it is just selling you, or it's just showing you the kind of level it can get to for, like, fanatic, you know, film buffs and, you know, just people that are really big fans of something. It was some of the things, the World War II stuff, and especially the moon landing stuff, I found to be entertaining and compelling, just purely from an entertainment standpoint.
Just because
sometimes it's, you can sit back and enjoy a good conspiracy theory.
Right.
And not have to take it seriously too much. And that was fun, and it was interesting to see, like, you know, the signs and stuff within the movie that conceivably could have
I mean, they definitely noticed stuff I had never noticed before.
Yeah, and that part was cool too, seeing, like, little Easter eggs or whatever.
Or just
having a different perspective on a movie. There's nothing wrong with that. But right. I don't, you know, for a second, I don't want to spend one more minute with these people talking about The Shining ever again.
First of all, you got something that a lot of the critics seem to be missing, both professional critics and just, you know, people who are commenting about this film, which is that some of the people were saying that this movie was presenting these theories as legitimate forms of film criticism. You know, and I do not think that's what the movie was about. I think the movie was about obsession. You know, and it honestly, like, at least thematically at times, kind of reminded me of, did you ever see that documentary, I Think We're Alone Now?
Mm.
It was a documentary about these two ultra scary, nutty, creepy fans of Tiffany, the 80s pop star.
Oh, no.
I couldn't even get through it. It's too creepy because these people are too nutty. You know? I mean, it's a much more extreme version of it, but. Or that famous guy that sent Bjork all those videos. You're familiar with that story, right?
No.
You know, oh, really? You never seen that? Okay. Well, there was a guy that eventually killed himself that was obsessed with Bjork and, you know, sent her all these nutty videos. I mean, this isn't quite like that. This is, you know, these are coming up with little pet theories and examining something to death. But it is. They are irrational theories.
Right.
They're crazy shit. And, you know, I mean, like,
they don't hold water. Some of them don't even amount to being actual theories. They're just pointing out little, you know.
Like, they'll see continuity errors and say that was their, you know, Kubrick symbolism for trying to, you know, present one of their crackpot ideas. And, like, no, they're continuity errors, man, you know.
Or it seemed like sometimes they didn't even have crackpot ideas so much as they saw things that weren't there that upon further investigation were never intended to be there, but they kind of read something into it that wasn't there.
Right.
And then from that they kind of said, like, you know, well, this could mean this, but it doesn't actually, like, it's not a cohesive, you know, therefore, The Shining is about this. It's just like, hey, I noticed this. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Some of the things they would point out did not even lend itself to their theory. You know, they would just point out some kind of weird thing. You know, like, I was a little torn on this film because I would have to say that I didn't really enjoy the film, to be honest, because, I appreciate kind of what the guy was doing, but, you know, the subtitle of the film is being an inquiry into The Shining in 9 parts. So I could see how, like, that subtitle could make you think you actually are going to get some sort of interesting examination of The Shining. It's only interesting in the sense that these people are fucking nutbags.
You know?
I had a difficult time enjoying the film because listening to these people, I really just wanted them to shut up. You know, like, I really was annoyed with them, you know, like, to the point to where I at times was not sure that I was enjoying myself watching this film because, you know, I just, like, especially, like, the, you know, like, the Apollo 11 guy, like, where you just start thinking, like, God, this is a movie about mental illness. You know, this is a movie about people, you know, who have some pretty serious psychological issues, you know, if they're seeing all this in The Shining, you know. But I was of two minds because at the same time that I was thinking that, which was the prevailing experience I had throughout the film, there was a little nagging part of me that was going, Now, come on, guys. You're so wrong, because clearly The Shining was made to sync up with Pink Floyd's album Metal 3 times. That's what Kubrick secretly did. And then I realized, oh, shit, I am one of these people. I am one of these fucking nutbags, you know? Now, granted, what separates me from them is that the metal thing, I do not believe 100%. I'm 50-50 on it, you know? But, I mean, back in high school, I was one of these people. I was one of these people that obsessed over Kubrick's films. He's still probably my favorite director. And I think his movies are flawed, you know? But I still think Kubrick tapped into something that few directors ever have. And I was one of those guys that did watch The Shining over and over again in 2001 over and over again. And I used to go to this website. It was called the Kubrick Floyd site. And on there, this was right around the time that people were doing the Dark Side Wizard of Oz thing, which I've always contended was total bullshit. You know, it's somewhat fun to do, but there's absolutely no way that was an intentional sync.
Right.
That Pink Floyd made that album to sync up with Wizard of Oz. I don't believe that for a second. However, there is one that has thankfully gotten more famous over the years, but there is one that I do think is about as real as can possibly be, which is that, and I learned from this Kubrick Floyd site, which is that the end of 2001, that's it's the chapter titled Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite, syncs up with the last song on Pink Floyd's album Metal, and that they're both 23 minutes and 23 seconds long, and if you play them at the same time, I mean, it's remarkable how well they synced up. And we've done this.
Yeah,
before,
you know, what was the song?
The song's Echoes.
Right.
It's called
Okay.
Echoes.
It was Echoes, and it was the scene where Jack goes into room.
Oh, no. I'm going to get to the Shining thing in a minute.
I'm talking about the
2001.
Okay, the 2001, yeah. Well, that were, yeah, exactly.
That one, I'm like 99.5% convinced is a fact. I mean, it's about as close to a fact as you can get that Pink Floyd did do the song Echoes to sync up with the end of 2001.
It's,
you know,
pretty much flawless.
Yeah,
a flawless sync, like,
right. But so we had been doing that for a couple of years, and I love to show that to people. I've seriously done that sync hundreds of times. But back in high school, I had done that 2001 thing so many times. I used to go to this Kubrick Floyd site, and that Kubrick Floyd site said that you can do this with The Shining as well. That if you play the entire album by Pink Floyd, Metal, 3 times in a row, that it syncs up pretty well as an alternate soundtrack to The Shining. And I had really convinced myself, after doing it many, many times, that it was very possible that Kubrick did do this, you know? And I know this sounds like nutbag stuff, and maybe it is. That's one thing that separates me, is that I will totally concede this could be totally wrong. And it's not my pet theory, you know?
Exactly. The main thing, is that it wasn't like you found this, like, somehow, and it's you're championing it. It was something that you saw.
I saw some other guys
say.
I went and tested it out, and I saw, well, you know what? There is some evidence for that. You
right.
know? And let's also talk about this for a second. You know, one of the sort of fascinating underground worlds of cult media stuff that people don't know about are these sync things, you know, and especially they really do exist with the Pink Floyd and Kubrick back to back. They had this relationship for many years of where they would try to work together and then it wouldn't work out, you know. At one point, Kubrick had asked Pink Floyd to do music for 2001, and they had turned it down, and Roger Waters has at times, I've seen this quote many times, but I've never actually seen it 100% validated, but Waters is often quoted as saying that one of his greatest mistakes was not contributing music to 2001 at the time, you know, when they were asked to do it. But at the time when they were asked to do it was, you know, 67. It was right when Syd Barrett had gone crazy and left the band. It would have been some weird-ass experimental Floyd that showed up on, you know, they weren't ready to do it, you know. Metal came out in 1971, you know, so they had a good 3 years to work on a song, you know, for 2001. When Kubrick was doing A Clockwork Orange, he asked if he could use music from Atom Heart Mother by Pink Floyd on it. And Pink Floyd said no. And they felt like that the songs were going to be used out of context and would seem inappropriate for the film. And to get back at them a little bit, during the scene when Alex goes into the record shop, Kubrick put Atom Heart Mother You can see the cover with the cowl. You can see that in the record shop sitting right there up front, you know, and that was a little dig at Pink Floyd there. When Roger Waters was doing his solo album Amused to Death, he asked if he could use the shutdowns, the Hal shutdown sequence at the, you know, towards the end of 2001, the, you know, when the, when Dave has to shut down the Hal 9000, you know, the, my mind is going, Dave, you know, will you stop, Dave? That whole thing, you know? Yeah. And Kubrick said no. Kubrick wouldn't let him do it. And so instead, Roger put in a backwards message that to Stanley. And it says, like, to Stanley and the other book club members, something, something, something. And then he starts screaming. But then when Roger Waters was doing his live tour in 2002, the In the Flesh tour, this was after Kubrick had died, he did use the Hal shutdown sequence for that song. It's Perfect Sense Part 2, I believe, is the song that he wanted to use it at. So they have this relationship going back decades of communicating with each other, wanting to work with each other, and it never coming to fruition, you know, and usually denying each other. So if one can concede that Echoes was made for the end of 2001, which is almost certainly true, then you have to assume that Kubrick had seen this. He had seen the Echoes sink at some point, you know. He probably saw it pretty soon after they did it, you know. And if you are, like, the, you know, the one of the world's greatest directors, do you really let them get away with that and not respond? You know, I would feel like Kubrick has got to do something to respond. And what do you do as a filmmaker to respond? It's a lot harder than making a song that syncs up with a titled segment of a film, you know. So if it's true, which I'm not saying it is, I think it would make sense that the only thing Kubrick could do would be to use an album, you know, three times or so, that would make it about feature length, and try to make a movie sync up with an album, you know, and the perfect album to choose would have been Metal, the one that Echoes was on, right, you know, and it does seem to work in many different segments, you know. Like, for example, I played for you one of the segments. Coincidentally enough, the Room 237 segment.
Right.
In the
which
film.
Was, you know, pretty... It seemed like a pretty decent sync. Like, it synced up really well to what was happening, enough to where it could have plausibly been a second soundtrack.
Right.
And this is now, the caveat is that it's not meant to play through the whole movie.
Right. It's supposed to be like an alternate soundtrack. So, like, when the dialogue comes on, you turn it down. You know, like, right, like where there would be, you know, the film score is where you would turn up this as... It's like an alternate film score.
Right.
You know, basically is what this would be. You know, or it's supposed to be either playing lightly in the background when there's dialogue, or, you know, on full blast when it's a visual sequence, you know. But, I mean, there's moments like, you know, where the song One of These Days, the only spoken line in One of These Days is, you know, it's a heavily, you know, whatever, altered voice, but it says, you know, one of these days I'm going to cut you into little pieces, is what it says in the middle of the song. And in one of the times when One of These Days plays is right after Danny sees the two twin girls all cut up, you know, is when that line comes on. You know, there's a lot of pretty crazy syncs in it that do make you scratch your head. There, it's at least interesting, if anything,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's fun. It's not, you're not obsessed with it.
Yeah, I'm not obsessed with it, you know. I don't even necessarily believe it, you know.
Right.
But it was just funny to, like, hate these people almost, be so annoyed with them, and then realize, God, I'm not that far from I'm not that far from this. I've had some obsessive moments almost over The Shining, you know.
But to be honest, the Pink Floyd thing is way more compelling of an argument than if you play The Shining backwards, superimposed on it playing forward, then this happens and this happens.
One of the theories is that, and he never, like, come out, and that guy who proposes that theory never comes out and straight up says he thinks that that's the way it was supposed to be made, but he definitely implies that that's, you know, that he thinks it was on purpose, where basically this guy plays, you know, The Shining backwards and forwards, overlapping each other, superimposed over each other. And sort of makes the suggestion that perhaps Kubrick did that on purpose, where there will be some little things that sync up and some little juxtapositions and stuff.
Because there's, like, two or three times where, you know, it does seem like, oh, that's a cool
image. Yeah, like, there's an interesting little, juxtaposition image, you know. But it's like, do you understand the mechanics it would take to make a film and know that, you know, okay, like, this will be 17 minutes into the film, and it'll be 17 minutes from the end, and I'll have this scene going on there, and I'll know exactly that these two scenes are going to overlap, and that, I mean, like, who even would have ever has the technology to not only play the film backwards, but to superimpose them over each other, you know, like, I mean, that's nutbag stuff. Yeah. That is absolute insanity stuff to think that Kubrick would do that, you know.
Or he's just really dumb.
Yeah,
or he just doesn't. He's not thinking things through.
Right.
He saw a few things. Yeah. It's like, what about the other like 2 hours of the movie that don't match up?
Right,
you're just completely like, this doesn't match at all. This is just I'm watching shit.
Yeah,
like, it's ruining the experience.
Totally. Well, and also one of the things that I think the reviewers missed about Room 237. The only reviewer I saw mention this specifically was Chuck Klosterman in his Grantland review, and he actually reviewed it, you know, last year when it was in the festival circuit. And strange enough, at the end of his review, he puts a YouTube link to the 2001 Echoes thing, but he doesn't mention it at all. He just puts it at the end. But anyway, he's the only one that mentioned this, which is that it's not really a coincidence that it is a Kubrick film that we see this on, that we see this level of obsession, you know? And I think one of the things that gets missed in the discussion about this is that it is those super amazingly, you know, powerful artists that and there's only a handful of them out there that can inspire this level of scrutiny and insanity, you know? And it's something in the tone of their work. It's there is something mysterious about Kubrick's work. There is something mysterious about Pink Floyd, you know, where you want to go find the puzzles, you know, you want to go figure the stuff out. And you know, the more you study, you know, like the making of these films and the albums and stuff, you know, you can be pragmatic about it, realistic about it, and say, well, you know, maybe they're just really good stuff, you know, maybe there's not necessarily hitting messages and all that stuff. But you could go the other way, too, you know? I mean, like, I've studied so much Kubrick, and I still think that, yeah, there absolutely might be some hidden, you know, interesting secret stuff going on in his movies, possibly. But the one thing I absolutely do know is that he had the ability to strike a tone with his films that gave you that feeling of this is, you're watching something that it's got layers to it that you don't even understand, you know, that and there's few artists that can pull that off.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, you know, I'd say maybe David Lynch has got some stuff like that, you know, I'd say, you know,
Zack Snyder.
Totally Snyder, yeah, no question about it, you know.
Sucker Punch.
I have not been able to wrap my head around the
mystery. I always thought Sucker Punch was about apartheid.
Totally. You know, and then music-wise, I'd say Radiohead has got a little bit of that.
Yeah,
Honestly, the band Tool has totally got a lot of that in it, you know. You know, the shtick's getting a little old with Tool, but, you know. But anyway, so, yeah, I don't know if I like the film 237, Room 237, but it certainly is about topics that I enjoy, you know.
Not only is it, you know, like, we enjoy reinterpreting films, we enjoy looking at things from a different angle and kind of getting, you know, like you said, like, finding the puzzles and stuff, but we're also, you and I are also kind of fascinated with people who just take themselves too seriously or take ideas too seriously or take things too far to the point where it starts to become a, maybe, you know, conceivably a problem. I think there's at least one person in that documentary that we both kind of felt afraid for. At least one.
Yeah, so, at least one. Because there was that one guy that gets up and his kid's crying in it. And he, like, do you hear that? Do you hear my kid crying? And he gets up and he, like, bangs on the wall.
Yeah.
And, like, you almost get a flashback of Jack Torrance in The Shining.
This is the guy at the end of the movie who says, like, I see a lot of myself in that movie. Or, like,
that's the guy. Yeah.
Same dude.
Yeah, you want to be like, dude, get help.
Yeah.
It's like, seriously, not even joking, like, call a therapist.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
stop watching The Shining so much. Fuck.
Totally.
All right,
totally.
Kubrick.
Oh, man. All right. Well, yeah, I'd say that probably wraps up our podcast for this week. And hopefully next time we do this, it won't be 3 weeks or a month. And hopefully we'll actually write some shit for the site.
I think so.
Yeah. We'll give that a go sometime soon as well. But thanks for listening to us if you did. And we'll catch you next time.
Take it easy. Bye-bye. Bye. Underneath this, I'm going to die.